Like, don't forget to record.
Never have. Once.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true. It's the blue frontier.
Welcome to the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host is Vicki Nichols Goldstein. And today we'll be talking with Margaret Spring, Chief Conservation and Science Officer for the world-famous Monterey Bay Aquarium. But before we do, Vicki, you've got some blue news we can use?
I do. Well, we all know that the Earth's oceans are responding in so many ways to climate change, whether it's sea level rise or marine heat waves or just a loss of biodiversity. But NASA, which is so amazing, has a new satellite mission to study ocean health, air quality, and the effects of a changing climate. So they are planning to collect data on the impact of these tiny microscopic life in the ocean. And then they're going to look at climate change's effects on phytoplankton. And we all know they play a key role in the global carbon cycle by absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So this data will allow scientists and coastal resource managers to forecast the health of fisheries, track harmful algae blooms, and identify changes in the marine environment. So how cool is that, that we're getting all of this from space?
Wow, looking at the tiniest living things on our ocean planet from thousands of miles up in space.
Yeah.
Well, I've got some agency news too. I was just reading a very detailed plan put together by the Heritage Foundation, other ultra-conservatives for the second Trump term. Among ideas like returning to the gold standard, it calls for abolishing NOAA, whose science they claim is, quote, promoting the climate change alarm industry, actually by reporting facts like 2023 being the hottest year in recorded history. It also recycles the idea that NOAA's National Weather Service should be privatized, though I don't know a lot of people who'd prefer to pay to find out if a hurricane's headed their way. I do know one of our previous guests who wouldn't agree with dismantling NOAA. That would be NOAA Administrator Rick Spinrad. Today's guest, Margaret Spring, before coming to the Monterey Bay Aquarium in 2013, was also in the leadership at NOAA. Today, she oversees the aquarium science policy work, Sustainable Seafood Watch, research, including at Embari, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. But before we get into all the amazing work you do, Margaret, maybe you could tell us how you first connected with the ocean in your youth.
Just like many people who come to the aquarium, I was sort of turned on to the ocean. Even growing up in the concrete jungle, so to speak, of New York City, where the closest water was the Hudson River, my first aquarium was the New York Aquarium. At the time, we called it the Coney Island Aquarium. We also spent a lot of time getting on the subway and venturing out there, and also taking trips to the beach at Jones Beach on Long Island. My father was particularly interested in eating off the land. He was a devotee of Yul Gibbons, if you'll remember him, stalking the wild asparagus and the blue-eyed scallop. This was a weird time in our lives because we were in an urban area. But in any case, he would take us out and we'd go snorkeling and diving on our own, harvesting food from the sea, mussels from the Long Island Sound. So I really got a chance to get a look at what the creatures were in the ocean, but also to be in it. And I think both are amazing. And we do offer those kinds of opportunities here at the aquarium. But I have to say that whether you grow up in Denver, Colorado, or somewhere even more remote from the ocean, which of course Denver is an ancient ocean, you really can go and do great things. Jane Lubchenco, Marcia McNutt, for those of you who don't know them, Jane was the first female head of NOAA. Marcia McNutt was the first female head of the USGS, both from Colorado. But I would say I entered it by eating seafood, by being in the ocean, and by just being turned on to also the weather and the climate aspects. At the time, it was just sort of phenomena that you noticed. The beach was cool, and then the city was hot. You understood these things. But then when I went to school later, had my first oceanography class in high school, in fact.
I didn't realize we were on the same track. My dad took me to the Coney Island Aquarium where we saw a beluga, and I used to always bug my mom to take us to Jones Beach. And first Sheephead Bay in Brooklyn was the first fishing trip where I caught a conger eel that was like a sea monster. So you came out, you got the oceanography class in high school. What was your career path to where you are?
After I left high school and went to college, I went to the great coastal college of Dartmouth College. There was a great oceanographer there, Charles Drake, who I wanted to take classes from. But in the end, I was choosing between oceanography and my love of history. And I ended up becoming a major in classical or Greek archaeology and spent a lot of time looking at how the Greeks used the ocean, which was sort of, I kept coming back to the ocean. But when I left, I went back on the track of trying to see if I could fit myself into the ocean world. And I took a free internship job, as many of us did, the Moat Marine Lab at the time. It wasn't an aquarium at the time, in Florida, in Sarasota, Florida. And I learned how to sort benthic samples and take water samples from rivers and get involved in a lot of environmental issues. I was a terrible, terrible field biologist, but I really loved data and reporting data and figuring out how government was going to use it to make decisions. And that hooked me. And so when I decided what my career path would be, I knew I wouldn't be a scientist. I think I kind of learned these things working for scientists. They're great, but if you're not as good as they are, you really know you got to do something else. And so I went to become a lawyer. My interest in going to law school wasn't just to be a lawyer, but it was to work in the ocean and environmental field. As you know, New York City is a ground zero for a lot of pollution. And I grew up during the PCB pollution era and a lot of and the creation of Superfund and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And those were all happening when I was a child, or not even a child, a teenager. And so I knew that there was a real role for getting involved in the law and policy and bringing science, or whatever my love of science, to that, and my respect for it. And so in the end, I went to law school, Duke Law School, and I was happened upon an advertisement for a Sea Grant fellowship on a lark. I put in my application and boom, within 6 or 7 months, I was on Capitol Hill working in the US Senate, the last place I ever wanted to be. I wanted to work at NOAA. It was such a cool agency.
What ocean policies while you were there?
Well, this is when I was a Sea Grant fellow. I worked on the It was the tail end of the Global Change Research Act, which was it came through our committee. And then I worked on, apparently there had been a failure of a satellite, the weather satellite, not only the weather satellite, but the hurricane satellite, the GOES satellite at the time, had failed. And it was a big uproar in Congress, and I had to staff an appropriations and an authorization committee hearing to berate the president of that company. So anyway, that's back in the dark ages, I would say, of 1991. And then fast forward, after spending 7 years in a law firm working as a counselor, counseling big companies on environmental compliance, I came back to the Senate, and my first bill was the creation of the Oceans Act of 2000, which was a Herculean effort, surprisingly, to get a commission on the ocean policy, which came out, the report came out just about the time the Pew Ocean Commission came out. So both two commissions, one private, one public, came together, came out with the same recommendations largely, and set us on a course for a really revitalized set of laws reforming US fisheries, the creation of the Marine Debris Program, the Oceans and Human Health Act. A number of things that are really modern ideas of how to move forward were put in motion by that. And Rick Spinrad was involved in that Ocean Commission too. So again, we're all connected. So that's how I ended up in the Senate. But when the new head of NOAA was named under the Obama administration, Dr. Lubchenco, they invited me to be her chief of staff. And I went back to Washington for 4 years, and we lived through Deepwater Horizon, ClimateGate, you name it. It was thrown at us. But this is an amazing place to be able to talk about what's possible.
No, it's a world-class aquarium. You not only have the central tank full of kelp and sea otters, but you go out on the deck there, and there's the actual kelp forest with sea otters, wild and tame. And you had a pregnant otter who came right up onto your aquarium shelf there to give birth and pup, take care of
I
its
think it
pup.
was the first live birth film ever, Seattle Pup. It shocked us, so it was amazing. But you're
So,
right, David and Vicky, our best exhibit is the Monterey Bay, and it's what inspires people. But our designers and our animal care staff would be worried if I didn't say anything more, but everything we have inside reflects what we see outside. And it is the same quality of amazement that people receive when they walk through any of these exhibits. And you're right, the majestic kelp forest, the tunas swimming, the wave that crashes over you when you
and
walk
the
through one part of it.
sardines that circle overhead. Oh my gosh, I love that exhibit.
It's great. And
And
you
you have a
notice the
midwife.
music too. The music is, it's pretty cool.
You
It
have
can put you in the mood.
a new one, the deep sea. I have not seen that one. So tell us a little bit about that.
So first of all, let me just say this is the 40th anniversary of the Monterey Bay Aquarium's opening, which is exciting. 2 years after our opening, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute was opened as sort of an offshoot and an idea from David Packard, who thought, well, why can't we get to the bottom of the ocean? Let's figure out how to get these engineers and scientists together to do it. And as David noted at the beginning, we're very close to the deep ocean right here because of this amazing Grand Canyon of the Monterey Bay Canyon, where you can really get to miles and miles deep right away. And so the aquarium's always been tied to talking about the deep ocean and the deep sea. But what the opportunity came up to actually plan an exhibit, which is quite technologically and technically difficult and expensive. And we were able to accelerate its progress because of the terrible closure we had here in during COVID. So we were closed for over a year, which was quite devastating. I won't linger on that, but it allowed for us to move fast with a special donation to do this exhibit, which is quite important because the deep ocean is under threat from many things, from climate change to deep ocean mining, which I know you care about a lot. The newest threats that are coming, which are, plastic pollution, chemical pollution, other sorts of pollution. So we combined our forces with our exhibit geniuses and our animal care team to come up with an exhibit that would showcase not only the amazing life through the video. So we have animals in exhibit, but Mbari has decades of deep sea, high quality video of things that you would never be able to see. So this exhibit gives you great visuals, gives you a sense of where the ocean is and how connected it is, the deep ocean. And then it takes you on a journey from the top all the way down through the sea bottom, this midwater. The midwater is where we talk a lot about microplastics and the impacts and how ubiquitous they are and what we found in a research program with Mbari, that most of the so much of the microplastics, even here in Monterey Bay, are at the midwater and the deep, which is all part of the big food system and the and so there's just a lot to know, and we use the journey that you take through that exhibit to learn a little bit about this and that, but just mostly keep your eyes open and just be amazed. I've had people just leave there, just think, wow, this is amazing. So
Well, I can't wait to go and see it next time I get to Monterey. I'm heading to the aquarium.
we hope so.
I want to talk a little bit about your sustainable seafood program. The Inland Ocean Coalition has been a partner for years, and in fact, I have some cards on my desk. But you have an amazing team of scientists and policy experts on these topics, and there are so many species to keep track of and constant sustainable updates. Give us an insight as to how this all works.
Well, you're right, Vicki, and thanks for mentioning that. It's the 25th anniversary of our Seafood Watch
Oh my
program. This is
God.
so you're just hitting
Celebration.
it. It's an exciting year for us. Certainly, this is something that started with an exhibit, where an ex exhibit was put forward, and it was called "Vanishing Wildlife," which, of course, was of concern to people, and they asked, "What can we do?" This is very directed to being responsive to how people care and they want to learn. And so we tried to give them answers at the time, which was many years ago, as you can tell. Here's a card. Here's what you can eat. And it turned into a huge part of the whole sustainable seafood movement around the world. And the back end of that is science. Science drives this entire process. Science brought the concern to the public, but also science can bring some of the solutions.
So I'd like to get back to the Embari because we have friends who run other great aquariums, the National Aquarium in Baltimore, the New England Aquarium in Boston. What they don't have is a major research lab attached to their aquariums. And I remember going out with the Embari research team, and literally by the time, you've got it at Moss Landing north of Monterey, where you're at the mouth of this incredible, deeper than the Grand Canyon, the submarine canyon in Monterey. We went out, it was snotty weather, really rough. Your chief scientist was dropping a big ROV, a remote operated vehicles, robot submarine in the water. I was getting sick, but a super pod of dolphins came along. There were albatrosses. I'm throwing up with 1,000 dolphins around me, albatrosses, and a rainbow. And it's sort of the best and worst of the ocean that it can throw at you. This is a huge science center. And as you said earlier, David Packard really wanted to put the biologists together with the engineers to see what's possible. And maybe you could just tell us some of the possible things they've done there in terms of exploring the deep ocean right off of Monterey.
Every day they're discovering new species, first of all. I mean, that's just an endless. And so they have a lot of that information and visuals on their website, a huge treasure trove of beautiful photography and real living animals in our ocean. So that's just a great asset that I think nobody else has in the same way with the same length of time. The other thing is that they've actually wired the canyon. So they've been listening and watching what's going on. It's probably one of the most observed canyons in the world. And a cool thing that they've been able to do is establish an acoustic listening room for all acoustics of all species. And so they've been able to discover there are beaked whales here, or there are whales we didn't even know that were there because we can now identify them by sound. And they have a lot of very interesting experimentation going. And actually, they've installed a blue whale acoustic listening sensor. So they really are developing lots of different kinds of sensors using engineering to evaluate what's happening in the ocean, whether it's temperature, whether it's acidification, or other things like that. Their biggest claim to fame, of course, is to actually be understanding the entire carbon cycle of the ocean, which is where all the pieces connect, whether it's plastic or climate. And they're very involved in this global array of observing buoys around the globe, which are actually now picking up not only information on temperature and other things like that, but also biological information, which is going to be critical for understanding what's happening to the productivity of the areas. And that goes into these big models that you see. But other things that they've developed are some the eDNA sensors, and they have a very interesting, they call it an ESP. Everybody loves their three-letter acronyms, but the Environmental Sample Processor, which actually can ingest water from a stream or the ocean and filter through it to identify eDNA, environmental DNA, the tiny, tiny specks of particles of skin and biological matter that helps you identify what creatures have been in that water. We
So
use.
literally you can send out a autonomous submarine or even dip off your boat and see the density of a certain species of shark in the area because their DNA is floating in the water.
Yes, I mean, I think that the potential is boundless. It's not just animals, it's also diseases. And so they're working with the USGS to monitor for certain kinds of viruses and pathogens in freshwater because they have sensors, but then they add this little thing. So I just feel like we're only at the beginning of seeing what these sensors can do. And they can be paired with the satellite data. Vicky, you're talking about satellite data. Satellite data, ocean-borne data, they all connect to information that's important in climate forecasting, but also understanding the status and trends of animals and growth and productivity in the ocean. So there's so many other examples of what they've done, but all these pieces and parts, and they're an ultimate partner with the federal agencies because they are luckily endowed with more funds, sustained funds from a Packard Foundation to support this work so that they have the ability to develop these sensors, test them in a real test bed of the Monterey Bay, and thinking about how you bring robotics, eDNA, acoustics together in one place to say what is happening in this area. There's some interesting stuff happening right there, collaborations that are beginning, which we're excited about, including to inform what we need to know about these places people are, the government and others are thinking of putting offshore wind or offshore arrays.
Margaret, you've been involved in this incredible global plastics treaty that the US joined a couple of years ago. And this is where Congress tasked the United States to figure out the role in plastic pollution and what to do about it. That's a huge job. And then you chaired the committee. So tell us about how you came into that role, what you did, and what the goals are.
Right. Well, the aquarium has been involved in plastic pollution for a while, and in the California, because California has been leading and taking action on plastic pollution, although, as you noted, global action is absolutely needed. And so we had some expertise there, and we had actually cleaned up our own aquarium in terms of our public facing areas from single use plastic. So we try and walk the talk, and that came to the attention, and I also of folks who've been following this issue. But I also had been on the Ocean Studies Board of the National Academy of Sciences, and so when they were tasked by Congress to come up with this report, which is a consensus report about what's happening, what's our role in this, I was asked to chair, which was thrilled by. And my background, as I noted, was as an environmental lawyer, and I was very experienced in hazardous waste and hazardous pollution and water pollution. So it's all sort of dovetails back to all these things that came together, and we had a terrific panel. We met all through COVID, never met in person until afterwards. And what we came up with was very informative and a pathway to success, at least for the United States, which we're still talking to the administration about. But that is that we can't just do one thing. We have to really think about changing our whole system. And states have been trying to do that. California's done a lot of amazing things, including with our support, including restricting the plastic packaging and all sorts of packaging, and putting targets and timetables on those restrictions, which are great. And that happened just about the time we, as a government, decided to join into the plastic pollution negotiations at the global level. So, as a result of my work on this report, I became the lead for the expert working group convened by an international science group called the International Science Council. And so I lead their delegation at these treaty meetings, which the United States is also at. So we're all sort of think everything's happening at once. Our major recommendation from that National Academy study was really important, which is the United States needs a comprehensive plan for plastic pollution. We do not have one. We have a little of this and a little of that, but nothing at the production end. You cannot stop the flow of plastic into the ocean or into the air or into our environment without dealing with where it's coming from, which is fossil fuels and fossil fuel production. As we bring down our emissions from transportation, much of the fossil product is now going into making chemicals and plastic. And so we have to deal with both.
It's so true. And right now, when you look at the numbers, plastic production is projected to increase 200% by 2035 and 350% by 2050. So when you said we have to do this, what is the plan? Because our numbers are increasing. How are we going to flip the switch and go backwards in our production?
Well, there are a couple of things. Certainly, there's a rubric there, or like a sort of statement that's being made is we need to get rid of problematic, unnecessary, and avoidable plastic.
Single use.
Yes, of course. And some things that are single use you absolutely need, maybe, but most of them, I think that many of us who are old enough to remember, we didn't have those. So go back to the future a little bit. We're giving away our age, maybe, but we didn't have those little plastic bags. We didn't have plastic utensils. We basically used reusable things. And this is an opportunity to change our system towards a more reusable world, first of all. But we actually have to look at production, and we have to look at not only the production of plastic, which is the turning of fossil fuels or any other, there are a couple other things you can make into plastic, and then the mixing with chemicals, which then leads to other problems. So one place we're trying to attack this, either in the United States or at the global level, and specifically at the state level where we're experiencing all of this garbage essentially, is that we need to identify the things we don't need in plastic. And then for the things we do need, we need to make sure that we're making it safe and sustainable.
We just had a tremendous, it was a 20-year battle, but a high seas treaty, which essentially will protect biodiversity on half the planet, which is that part of the ocean that's not within national exclusive economic zones. And the US played a very positive role. Do you see this global plastic treaty coming to fruition anytime soon? And are you hopeful that that level of international agreement can be reached in the face of strong opposition by the fossil fuel sector?
I think we're at a critical moment right now. What's exciting about this global plastic treaty is it's on a 2-year time frame, which is unheard of in international law. And we are sticking to the idea so far that we're going to have an agreement by the end of this calendar year. Now, that also puts a lot of pressure on the system. And you're correct, change is going to be opposed by many. There was just a meeting in Nairobi where there was a stocktake of how this is going. The countries there reaffirmed the need to get with this. So we'll be heading into Ottawa with a very strong message for all countries, including the United States, that we have to get serious about this. Now, the US is starting to develop their own plan, and I can see it's challenging to have a plan that you're building that we called for in the National Academies report and also negotiate it at a treaty. However, the recommendations from science have been clear. We haven't been wishy-washy about it. And the framework for the treaty right now is set up to reduce problematic polymers, reduce problematic materials, reduce chemicals, deal with recycling, deal with, there's all sorts of stages, just as we asked for in the National Academies report. It's very full life cycle.
I love that we have something positive to look forward to in 2025 with reducing our plastics and moving forward as a global effort to just deal with this, oh, this plastic that we all know is such a big problem. Oh, good work. Good work.
I do always feel optimistic when I'm coming out of a surf session or a good dive, or even an experience like I get when I go visit the Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Woohoo! Well, with that, Margaret Spring, Chief Conservation and Science Officer for the Monterey Bay Aquarium, thank you so much for being on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. It was delightful. Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast, is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by Blue Frontier's David Helbard and Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Kate May. You can find Rising Tide at bluefront.org or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget to recommend the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast to your friends and other ocean lovers.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky, there you are. Good boy, Sparky.